The next case on calendar for argument is Cruise Lines International Association versus Suganuma. Please approach, counsel. It's my understanding that there would be time shared. Would you please inform the court as to how the time will be shared?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm Ben Snyder, appearing on behalf of the private plaintiffs. I'll be taking 10 minutes. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Weisbuck from the Department of Justice will be representing the United States. My understanding is that he'd also like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, counsel, please proceed and watch your time.
Oops. May it please the court. As Judge Hurwitz and Judge Bress recognized in granting an injunction pending appeal, Act 96 likely violates federal law and therefore should not be permitted to take effect while this case proceeds. That's true for three reasons. First, Act 96 is expressly preempted by the Rivers and Harbors Act, or RHA, which provides that no taxes, tolls, operating charges, fees, or any other impositions whatever shall be levied upon or collected from any vessel if the vessel is operating on any navigable waters subject to the authority of the United States. Any plausible reading of that statutory text covers Act 96's taxes and registration fees. Defendants argue that Act 96 is permissible because the vessel owner, rather than the vessel itself, has to make the payments. But the RHA applies not only to impositions collected from vessels, but also to impositions levied upon vessels. And as Governor Green's office put it, Act 96 levies the TAT on cruise ships that port in the state. That's a direct quote.
No, counsel, not to put too fine a point, because it seems a little bit like the tail wagging the dog here, but I understand the argument on the tax. The registration fee I'm less clear on. I don't understand why the registration fee necessarily violates or conflicts with the RHA, because it doesn't seem to be, tied to passengers necessarily.
So under the RHA, the registration fee doesn't need to be tied to passengers in order to be preempted. It's sufficient that it's tied to a vessel. And the registration fee is specific to each vessel. It's actually specific to the size of the vessel. So there's a separate registration fee. I mean, I agree with you. This is not the big bucks issue, but the registration fee for transient accommodation with more than 6 units is $15. Whereas the registration fee for a smaller accommodation is less. So this is very specifically tied to the size of the vessel and the vessel itself. And we think that the RHA just makes the case.
You say RHA says no tax. No tax means no tax. They couldn't do a $5 license fee for any, just any vessel if they didn't grade it, charge larger vessels more, that wouldn't matter. There's just no tax.
That's correct. But I think the fact that it differs based on the size of the vessel just sort of makes it stronger, ties it back that this really is very focused on the vessels. And then we've also argued that Act 96's registration fee and the tax itself are unconstitutional under the tonnage clause. The Supreme Court has interpreted the tonnage clause to require require congressional authorization for any fee imposed for the privilege of lying in port. And for similar reasons that that Act 96 violates the RHA, it also violates the tonnage clause. It requires payment of a fee as a condition precedent to docking in Hawaii.
So what can Hawaii charge? I mean, they obviously bear some cost in allowing these ships to come in. Your point is they can charge for the cost of towing them in. They can charge a docking fee?
They can. So to be clear, CLIA's members pay significant amounts of money every year for services that are actually provided to the vessels in Hawaii. We are not objecting to that. The RHA has an express exception for services that are tied to the reasonable cost of providing those services. The problem is that here, Hawaii has come in and decided to impose additional charges, tens of millions of dollars every year, that have nothing to do with the services that CLIA's members were already providing. Those taxes are to support general revenue and to go to climate change projects and beautification projects, things like that, that are just far afield from the sorts of fees that Congress allowed under the RHA and that the Supreme Court has said are permissible under the tonnage clause.
Counsel, were you planning to address the Tax Injunction Act?
Only if you'd like me to, Your Honor. I'd be
like
glad
to
go through the entire time
like
without it.
I would like you to address whether or not the Tax Injunction Act bars your client's claims, not the federal government, but your client's claims.
So it doesn't, and even the district court recognized that it doesn't bar the challenges to...
Well, I'm asking you to tell me. I'm not asking what the district court recognized. I'm asking you why doesn't it bar?
So there are different reasons to the three different things we're challenging. We're challenging the registration fees, the notice requirements, and then the tax itself. And I'll take them in that order.
Take the tax first, because that's what the Tax Injunction Act addresses.
I agree with you. I don't think the Tax Injunction Act applies to the other two. The other side is disagreeing. But let me take the tax. The problem there is that Hawaii purports to offer two different avenues by which CLIA's members could challenge those in state court, and neither one is sufficient. The first avenue they argue is that the CLIA's members could wait until the state imposes an assessment and then could challenge the assessment in state court. The problem with that is that Hawaii can wait 4 years to impose that assessment, which doesn't satisfy the speedy requirement under the Tax Injunction Act. In Rosewell, Justice Blackmun concurred. He provided the fifth vote in that case, and he said that the regime at issue there, in which you would get a complete decision on the challenge within 2 years in the state courts, only barely satisfied the Tax Injunction Act, the speedy requirement. Here, Hawaii could wait 4 years from when the first, more than 4 years from when the first payment is made to issue the assessment. So we think it's clear that assessment method is not permissible. Now, in the Polynesian Airlines case, this court found that the assessment method was permissible. The difference was that in that case, the assessment had already been issued by the time the case came to the courts. So there was
why do we have to look at the latest possible date of an assessment?
So in Hibbs versus Wynn, the Supreme Court in footnote 10 of that decision said that the statute requires the state to provide taxpayers with a swift and certain remedy when they resist tax collections, and action dependent on a court's discretion would not qualify as a fitting taxpayer's remedy. You have the same thing here. What they're saying is we have discretion to issue an assessment earlier, but that's not what the Tax Injunction Act looks to. The Tax Injunction Act looks to whether the taxpayer has a right to challenge it sooner.
Right, but I'm just wondering, why would we assume that it's going to be the latest possible date?
Because, Your Honor, if you don't assume that, if you assume that, you know, that the tax collection agency is always going to proceed with the sort of greatest possible dispatch, the speedy requirement has no meaning at all.
Do we have a history? Sometimes we have a history of what happens in these circumstances. Do we have anything that would give us an inkling as to how these are actually processed, how these claims are actually processed?
No, we don't, because it's a new tax. Mm-hmm. But I would say that you look to what the sort of maximum time is that they could wait, and here it's 4 years. I want to reserve some time, but I also want to just briefly address on the refund claim. I think the biggest problem with the refund claim is that it's just not applicable in terms of judicial review for the claims against the counties. There is no provision in Hawaii law that allows for judicial review of a county's denial of a refund. They haven't pointed to any. They pointed to the Aloha Motors case, which just doesn't deal with county-level refunds at all. So we think that there's just not a path to get those into judicial review. So neither of those avenues works. And then, of course, the United States is also here, and I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mike Weisbuck for the United States. As Mr. Snyder said, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes. I'll start with jurisdiction, although I think it's pretty clear for the United States. We have a robust view of our general standing to vindicate the supremacy of federal law. But in this case, it's enough to just reaffirm what the court said in Little Man in the Boat at page 961, which was that the free movement of commerce is an interest, quote, historically safeguarded by the federal government. And that was discussing the RHA in particular.
So what about the Tonnage Act? If I understood your argument to be that the United States has standing under the RHA, and then you seem to be arguing you have some quasi-sovereign interest under the Tonnage Act, that and the United States has standing there as well, which I think if we agreed with that, we would create a circuit split with the Third Circuit.
I don't think it would create a circuit split to say that as a general matter, the United States suffers a sovereign injury when it asserts a burden on maritime commerce.
That's pretty broad.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that's what the Supreme Court has said going back to In re Debs and on through Sanitary District of Chicago.
Argument is that the United States has standing to intervene in any act that involves maritime commerce. Is that your argument?
Not any act that involves maritime commerce.
But what's the extent of the United States' interest in maritime commerce? How far does that go in your view?
Well, the Constitution and federal law have created what amounts to a federal domain over the imposition of taxes on maritime commerce. So anytime a state purports to intrude on that federal domain, the United States suffers a sovereign injury. I actually think the Supreme Court has said much broader things about the United States standing. In the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources decision, it referred to an injury to its sovereignty arising from violations of its laws, full stop. Here, the court doesn't need to go that far. The court doesn't need to say the federal government always has standing to assert claims under the Supremacy Clause. The court can just go as far as I said, which is to say when there's an intrusion on a federal domain like maritime commerce, then the United States has standing. And I think the Supreme Court has said this in black and white. If you look
at the case that you rely on most strongly to support the proposition that any time there is maritime commerce, and I don't know that you put any limits on it, there's a statute involving maritime commerce, the United States has standing. Am I paraphrasing what you said correctly?
Well, even then, the court doesn't need to go that far. This isn't a statute
involving... Well, I'm asking you, what is your theory? If we were to write this opinion, what would we say about the United States standing in terms of maritime commerce? How would we phrase that from your view?
I think you could write a broad opinion, but if Judge Rawlinson, if you're suggesting you'd rather write a narrower
opinion...
No,
I'm not suggesting anything. I'm just asking you, what is your position
right
on the outer boundaries of the United States standing vis-a-vis maritime commerce? I'm just asking you what your opinion is, what your theory is, how far does it go? What would we say? We would say the United States has standing when...
The United States at least has standing to assert its sovereign power to regulate commerce and control navigable waters within its exclusive jurisdiction. And that's exactly what Sanitary District of Chicago Justice Holmes said. So our standing is at least that broad, and that's exactly the theory of standing that we're asserting here.
Do we need to go any further than the taxing authority here?
I'm sorry?
Do we need to go any further than the taxing authority? I mean, you're asking us... I think maybe what's confusing us is the only question here is a tax, right?
Correct.
So why don't we just say the United States has authority to get involved in a tax that violates federal law?
I think you could absolutely – that would be an alternative framing.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So were you going to suggest that we not reach the tonnage clause, that we just decide this based on the RHA?
I think you can just decide it based on the RHA. The RHA has the benefit of having a very clear and very broad textual prohibition on any impositions, whatever, imposed by any non-federal interest. And to the court's question in the order last week, I think that's clearly an express preemption provision. The reference to any non-federal interest unambiguously preempts covered state and county taxes. And then the RHA also has the benefit of enumerating exceptions, none of which Hawaii argues apply here. So I think it's a clean way to resolve
it. Could it be field preemption, or do the exceptions negate the idea that it would be field preemption?
That's a good question. I think I would characterize it as express preemption that almost has the feel of field preemption because of how broadly the general prohibition is worded. Any vessel, any imposition, whatever, any navigable waters, any non-federal interest. But those exceptions do carve out narrow categories where state laws are permitted. So I think whether you want to apply the label of field preemption, it's very broad express preemption, and broad preemption that doesn't leave any room for Act 96, because this is a imposition on vessels, as I think everyone in Hawaii understood until this litigation. And
it's not interfering with any federal taxation scheme, though, is it?
Well, it's interfering with the uniformity of federal control over maritime commerce.
Right, but my question was more specific. Is it interfering with any federal taxation scheme?
I'm not aware of a direct conflict with a separate federal taxation scheme, but that would just be an additional basis for preemption.
I'm just trying to get what your argument is.
Right, that would be a separate basis that Act 96 is preempted.
But we don't have that here.
Twice over. No, what we have is preemption based on the RHA and the tonnage clause. So I guess that would be three times over if there was another tax regime that this conflicted with. But one point I want to make about how this tax actually works in practice, because I think it's important. It confirms that this is an imposition upon a vessel, is that when you look at a cruise fare, what is actually being taxed, a significant chunk of that cruise fare goes towards interstate maritime transportation. So they can't just label this an accommodation tax when the $100 million they expect to raise each year, a big chunk of that is coming from maritime transportation specifically, and necessarily you can't. Whatever you can do with meals and unbundling meals from hotels and cruise ships, you can't unbundle the transportation. That's what a cruise fare is. So because of that, I think it confirms that this is an imposition on a vessel. And although we reject the idea that there's some exception for generally applicable taxes, or that you need to look to whether this applies in the same manner, this also confirms that this is not just an extension of a hotel tax to cruise ships, because hotels don't bundle maritime transportation. They might bundle other things, but those things aren't protected by the RHA or other federal law or the tonnage clause. So I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Well, is anyone going to address the local business plaintiff's interests?
I represent the United States.
Okay, all right. I was just curious. All right, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Andrew Teo for the State and County Defendants. In response to Judge Nelson's questions, the plaintiffs confirmed the sweeping nature of their ask, an immunity from virtually all state taxation that falls on businesses on ships. Not only has no federal court ever recognized such an immunity, but every federal court presented with a similar ask has squarely rejected it. As a result, states across the country tax businesses and economic activity that happens on ships. To name a few, Alaska levies an income tax on shipping companies, including those domiciled out of state. Florida imposes a sales tax on the rental of boats. Texas collects a franchise tax from ships, apportioned by the number of days spent in Texas ports.
Yeah, but none of those seem to go to the cargo inside the ship, and that seems to be what we're struggling with is, I mean, the RHA phrases it in terms of no tax on the vessel or passengers or crew. The tonnage clause seems to be gained at, you know, what's in it. I mean, I think there are taxes that can be used You want to rent a slip? You know, yeah, you can do that. You want to charge them to, you want to do a sales tax? You can do that. But what you seem to not be able to do is impose a tax on the crew or the passengers themselves.
We think it's permissible under the tonnage clause of both the RHA to tax.
Well, but none of the examples you gave went to that. So could you point to an example where you said every court that's looked at this has rejected this? Where is the court that has said a tax on crew or passengers or things that are in the ship, that's okay?
So the examples I pointed to were the Alaska example, for example. It's about the income that the company operating the ship is generating. So that includes all the money that they're deriving from the transportation of cargo. We think that's similar to this case. It's a tax on the gross receipts received for the business of providing accommodations. As to your comment specifically about crew, federal law allows income taxes to be levied against crew members. We think the plaintiff's reading of the RHA would read that out of the federal statute. This is a tax imposed on the business of providing short-term accommodations. So it's similar to an income tax levied against a business that happens to be on water. And the Supreme Court has upheld those types of taxes. Now, granted, they weren't brought as tonnage clause challenges. Typically, they're commerce clause challenges because the question is whether there's a sufficient nexus between the economic activity that's happening on the ship and the taxing jurisdiction. But that's a question that's considered under the tonnage clause framework, under the commerce clause framework, not under the tonnage clause. So I'd point the court, you know, there was a 1936 decision, Matson Navigation Company, and the state of California was imposing an income tax on Matson, a cargo shipping company, and the court upheld that under a commerce clause challenge. I'd also point the court to Alaska versus Arctic Maid. It's a 1961 Supreme Court decision, and the court upheld a tax against the business of freezing ships. They were used for fishing outside of Alaska's territorial waters. And one of the arguments that the plaintiffs raised there is that part of what we're doing is interstate commerce. We're moving fish interstate. Not all of this activity is happening within Alaska. And the court nonetheless allowed this tax to be upheld as assessed against the business of freezing ships. So we think the distinction that the tonnage clause is getting at is between a tax against the ship itself for the privilege of access to a port and a tax against the business activity that happens to be on the ship. This is a distinction that the court has drawn. So in the Wiggins Ferry Company case, the court upheld a license tax that was levied for the privilege of transporting passengers. So as a precondition for a ferry to be moving passengers in between states, a municipality was levying an income-generating, a revenue-generating tax against that business. And the court said that was permissible because...
I'm struggling with your distinction and want to make sure I understand your argument. You're suggesting that the tax is not on the business of operating the vessel. It's not on the business of operating a cruise ship. It's on lodging passengers temporarily?
That's correct. It's tied entirely to the provision of short-term accommodations. So if I could provide an example that I think helps to illustrate...
Well, but counsel, it's not. I mean, when you buy a cruise fare, part of what you pay is for the lodging, but there's a whole bunch. I mean, usually you're paying for all the food, all the service, all the games, all the shows, everything else. So it's not like a hotel tax where I go and stay at a hotel and I pay, you know, $200 for the hotel night. I'm paying much more than that because there's so much else that's tied up in that cabin.
Well, what's being captured by the TAT tax are all the mandatory charges that any transient accommodation provider passes along to the consumers. So if a land-based hotel is offering complimentary transportation services to and from the airport or around the island, that's being taxed. The land-based hotels have really elaborate resort amenities. The cost that a consumer is paying for that is being captured in the TAT, and the same is true for a cruise ship. Now, there may be different amenities that different providers choose to offer, but that doesn't defeat that the tax is being applied against the gross receipts for the provision of short-term accommodations. We think a similar argument could have been raised in Wheeling Transportation Company, where the Supreme Court upheld a personal property tax, against all property within the jurisdiction. The ship owner there could have said, we have a mast, we have an engine room, we have portholes, we have all of these vessel-related attributes that no other property within the jurisdiction has, and that wasn't part of the court's analysis. The court upheld the property tax all the same, and so we think that the fact there are some differences in the different amenities that different providers offer doesn't make a difference for purposes of the tonnage clause.
Go ahead. Does it matter that a ship moves? I mean, it seems like you're arguing that a ship is essentially a hotel, but on the water. So if a cruise ship were just docked at a port in Hawaii and people would come and stay on the ship, but it didn't move anywhere, it didn't go anywhere in the water, that would seem maybe like a stronger argument that this is just a tax on the provision of lodging as opposed to a tax on a vessel.
Well, we agree that the tax would be applied the same if the cruise ship were just docked, but we know it's not a tax on the transportation of passengers because any ship can transport passengers in between islands, and if they disembark when they get to the shore, they will not be assessed a liability.
Wait a minute, but if a cruise ship comes into a Hawaiian port, the tax is assessed, right, based on however many nights they're there?
If it's providing short-term accommodations while it's in port, correct. But if a cruise ship were, say, you know, traveling from California and it docks in Honolulu Harbor and it just and the passengers just disembark without providing short-term accommodations within the state's jurisdiction, the tax wouldn't be assessed against that ship. It turns on the provision of short-term accommodations, not on the transportation of passengers. So that's how we know that what this tax is for.
But if a passenger pays $5,000 for a ticket, and they leave Los Angeles and they go to Honolulu and they stay one night in Honolulu, you're charging tax on $5,000 for the full amount, aren't you?
So if it was 1 day, you know, 3 days at.
I'm just trying to make it simple. I don't think this cruise exists. 1 day cruise, one night in Honolulu, direct from LA. I pay $5,000 for the fare.
In the hypothetical, that's correct. But the point is that
what's correct that the entire $5,000 would be taxed?
I mean, if it's an instantaneous transportation, so you know they leave LA and they immediately arrive in Honolulu, so they spend a night in Honolulu Harbor, that would be the cost of providing the short-term accommodation. And under the statute and the rules as they exist now, that's what would be assessed.
See, that seems to run up against RHA, which says no taxes, tolls, operating charges on any passengers or crew if the vessel or watercraft is operating on any navigable waters. I mean, in the scenario I gave you, 98-99% of the operation of the vessel is on navigable waters, and yet you're trying to charge the whole $5,000. I mean, you might have a better case if you tried to do it, you know, just based on the port. But that doesn't seem to be what – this isn't carved out that way.
With respect to your hypothetical, Judge Nelson, I think it touches on Judge Beatty's question earlier, which is if the cruise ship was just docked in the port and providing short-term accommodations, the tax could be assessed against the provision of those short-term accommodations. In your hypothetical, there's really no time being spent for the transportation of passengers. And so because – you know, with the instantaneous – trip from LA to Honolulu Harbor, the full duration of that trip would effectively be spent in Honolulu Harbor, and so the tax would be assessed against the entirety of the fare. I would just, I mentioned earlier Alaska versus Arctic Maid. That's the case in which the court upheld a state tax against the revenues derived from operating freezer fish, and one of the arguments was that there was transportation being part of what was being taxed was the value of the transportation services. And what the Supreme Court said is, quote, part of the business is, of course, transporting frozen fish interstate. Yet it is plain that a freezer ship is more, much more than an interstate carrier. And the court upheld the tax even though part of the revenues derived from that were necessarily from the service that they were providing for transportation. So the question is, what is the core taxable activity? And here, the core taxable activity that the statute is targeting is the provision of short-term accommodations. And the fact that there are other amenities that may be offered doesn't change what the tax is being assessed against.
Counselor, did you cite that case in your brief, Alaska versus Arctic Maine?
We didn't cite that case, but it's discussed in North Pacific Fishing Company.
Well, so I was just wondering, because if you say that case is dispositive, I was curious why it wasn't cited in your briefs.
Yes. So with that case, it's a commerce clause challenge. So it's not a tonnage clause challenge. Mm-hmm. We think that gets to a broader thematic point that we make in our briefs, which is the tonnage clause is just a single tool within the constitutional framework for regulating interstate commerce. So to the extent that there are questions about the apportionment of the tax and whether the tax is capturing activity that can be reasonably attributed to the state of Hawaii, we think that those are questions for the Commerce Clause framework.
Well, that doesn't seem to comport at all with the – I mean, granted, the Supreme Court hasn't weighed in very often on this. But the Supreme Court seems to have I don't think I've ever read anything that the tonnage clause is coextensive with the commerce clause.
So we don't think that it is, and we think that that's the point. The tonnage clause is intended to facilitate these broader goals of interstate commerce, but it's narrowly about particular fees that the framers wanted to prescribe, which are fees for the privilege of access to a port. And so if a fee is operating or a tax is operating for the privilege of access to a port, then that would be presumptively barred by the tonnage clause. But every fee assessed against a ship isn't a fee for privilege of access to the port. So the income taxes that I mentioned at the top, if there's a transportation company like Matson or another cargo company that has a connection to a state, that state can tax the income from that business, even though that entire income is derived from transportation services. So the question is not whether the tax is being assessed against the business, but whether it's being assessed against the vessel for the act of entering the port and docking in the port.
But this isn't an income tax. I mean, you're not. It seems to be something in addition to and different from the tax that these companies would pay for, when they do their business return and they pay tax on their income.
I don't believe that. I'm not sure if the cruise ships here are paying income tax in Hawaii. I believe most of them are foreign flagged, so I think that there's some special protections for international ships. But the point is that it's getting at the business activity. So we think an income tax and a gross receipts tax are similar, and that they're targeting the business or economic activity that's happening on the ship. And that's distinct against a tax or a fee imposed against the ship itself.
So this argument is what the district court accepted and cited, State of Alaska versus North Pacific Fishing and Real Hooker Sport Fishing versus Department of Taxation. These two cases that the district court cited to draw this distinction and say, if you're taxing business, it's not the same as taxing the vessel.
That's correct. We think that distinction is right, and we think that those two cases support it.
Counsel, did you want to address the Tax Injunction Act at all?
Sure, Your Honor. As applied to CLIA or the United
yes.
States, I'm happy to. As applied
yeah,
to CLIA,
I don't think the United States would be barred from its claims. Do you think the Tax Injunction Act would bar the United States claims?
We do, Your Honor. Like we argue in our briefs, the United States doesn't point to any case that recognizes a categorical exemption from the Tax Injunction Act for the federal government. The rule is instead the Federal Instrumentalities Doctrine. So where the federal government or one of its instrumentalities will be subject to state taxation, by virtue of sovereign immunity, they can proceed in federal court and circumvent the Tax Injunction Act's jurisdictional bar, but that exception has never been extended broader than that. So there's no case that any court has ever recognized this categorical exemption. The one case to have considered the issue is the County of Nassau case from EDNY, and that court squarely rejected it. It called the proposition that the United States could have this categorical exemption remarkable. Plaintiffs in their brief cite to the Arkansas case. The United States cites to the Arkansas case. where there is an isolated statement that where the United States is a party, the Tax Injunction Act doesn't apply. But the court very clearly cabined its analysis, both preceding that and following that, to this federal instrumentalities doctrine. So the United States here is not going to be subject to the tax. So we think the Tax Injunction Act would apply. Even, yes, Your Honor.
But the you know, I thought the United States' position was we have a sovereign right here because taxes that are done in violation of our sovereign authority are being taxed. Why doesn't that give it a right? It doesn't have a way to challenge that under Hawaii law, does it?
We point out in our briefs that intervention would be on its face, it appears to be a remedy available to them. And the United States doesn't meaningfully
intervention in what? In a challenge to the tax?
Yes, in the underlying state tax dispute. So one of CLEAR's members is going to file, presumably if this court would block their action here, would file a tax refund action in state court, either under the assessment or the refund action procedure. And then on its face, the tax appeal court rules would provide for intervention. Plaintiff's only response is that, you know, we reserve the right to make any arguments about any action below, including intervention. But that's not dispositive for the purposes of the Tax Injunction Act. In Air Polynesia, the state was actively contesting jurisdiction in the assessment procedure, and the court still held that that action, that there was an adequate remedy in state court, even though there was.
But have you have not withdrawn your right to oppose their intervention in state court, right?
That's correct. But, you know, in Air Polynesia, this
seems a little hard to come in and say, oh, well, they have a right. But guess what? When they use that right, we're going to oppose it.
Again, in Air Polynesia, the state was actively contesting jurisdiction in the assessment procedure and saying the remedy was closed to the taxpayer.
Well, I just don't see how this is what's the statutory term? Speedy, efficient, a plain, speedy, and efficient remedy for the United States to intervene in state court when you yourself as a state have said we'll oppose their intervention to begin with.
The one thing I'll add, Your Honor, is that the only case plaintiffs cite for the proposition that a remedy can be insufficiently plain is the Hillsborough case. And in Hillsborough, there was a single state court decision suggesting a remedy might be available. There were decisions predating and postdating that decision that held it was squarely foreclosed. So in light of the affirmative evidence that a remedy was unavailable, the court concluded that it was insufficiently plain. But here on its face, the procedures have intervention available in tax appeal court. Judge Rawlinson, to your question about the Tax Injunction Act as applied to CLIA, their argument about the remedy being insufficiently speedy, you asked whether or not there were any examples of it being insufficiently speedy, and they say no because this is a new tax. The TAT has been assessed against hotels for decades. If there was any practice of this remedy being insufficiently speedy, they could have produced evidence here. It's plaintiff's burden to show.
But the United States doesn't, they don't have to intervene in those cases, do they? Your position is because we have imposed taxes on land-based hotels and we've been able to do that in a speedy way, that shows that the TIA precludes the United States action here. But my question is, the United States isn't ever involved in those cases because there isn't an equivalent RHA sovereign interest they're trying to defend, is there?
I think your answer was talking about CLIA.
Yes.
Not the United States.
I was discussing the Tax Injunction Act as it applies to CLIA. So for the speediness, it's plaintiff's burden to establish subject matter jurisdiction that includes the Tax Injunction Act doesn't apply. And here they just haven't made even allegations that the state is going to wait 4 years before the assessment is levied. I see that my time is coming to an end.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Yes. You want to wrap up?
Yes, we just ask that the court affirm the district court's denial of the preliminary injunction. Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. A few quick points. Mr. Teo said that every federal court to have addressed this issue has come out their way. He didn't specify what those courts were. I'm frankly not sure. The only one I'm aware of that has resolved a claim like this on the merits is the Mayer Terminals case. Mayer Terminals involved a tax on land-based property. It didn't involve a tax on vessels or the revenue from vessels or anything like that. So this sort of broad pronouncement, if you push past it. It just doesn't work. The best illustration of that is that when he went on to list cases, he identified a bunch of cases that are not cited in the briefs and that did not involve the tonnage clause or the RHA, which I think is a pretty strong tell that they don't have much to go on the things that are actually raised here. The other thing I didn't hear Mr. Teo talk about is the text of the RHA. The text of the RHA says that no impositions whatever may be imposed or may be levied on vessels. And as I pointed out in my opening, Hawaii has acknowledged time and time again that Act 96 levies taxes on vessels. So Governor Green's office, after the tax was enacted, said very clearly that, I'm quoting, that Act 96 levies for the first time the TAT on cruise ships that port in the state. That is acknowledging a violation of the RHA. The existing TAT says, this is in section 237D-15B, it describes the transient accommodations tax as being, quote, levied, assessed, and collected upon transient accommodations, close quote. That is, again, an acknowledgement that this tax is being levied on cruise ships. Judge Beatty, you asked about the Mayer Terminals case in the Third Circuit. As I suggested, I don't think there's any suggestion that there would be a conflict between a decision in our favor here and that case there, because that case didn't involve taxes on vessels at all. It was taxes on land-based property. That was the primary problem with the merits of that claim.
Was that case addressing whether the plaintiffs were in the zone of interest of the statute?
It does. So the case says that in order to come within the zone of interests of the RHA, the plaintiff needs to challenge injury because of a tax imposed on a vessel. It wasn't present there because the tax was being imposed on the marine terminals, the land-based property. Here it is being imposed because, as I just said, Hawaii has acknowledged that this tax is levied upon cruise ships. The final thing I'll say, and I apologize for running over my time, but is that my friend talked about income taxes and sales taxes. I think all of those, you don't need to discuss those. Those are worlds away from this one, because none of those taxes speak specifically about imposing a tax for the number of days that a vessel spends in port.
All right, Counselor, I understand your argument. Thank you.
Just a few quick points from me as well. So on jurisdiction, I'll sort of finish where I started with Little Man in the Boat. This court rejected the availability of a private right of action for damages under the RHA in part because it said this is historically an area that the federal government comes in and enforces. So I think it would be very odd to suggest that the United States doesn't have standing to assert a violation of the RHA. On the Tax Injunction Act, it's not just the Arkansas Supreme Court decision's isolated statement that the Tax Injunction Act doesn't apply when the United States is a party. If you look at the reasoning of that opinion and where that statement comes from, it's not just this instrumentality doctrine. There's a clear statement rule, and that rule is, quote, it's well settled that the government is not bound by its own legislative restrictions of remedial rights unless the intent to bind is expressed. There's no express intent to bind the United States in the Tax Injunction Act, just like there's no express intent to bind the United States in the Anti-Injunction Act, where courts have long held that it simply doesn't apply when the U.S. is a party. But again, the court doesn't need to go that far. There's clearly no plain remedy for the United States. Opposing counsel said that we hadn't cited cases showing that there's no plain remedy, but Hyatt v. Yee at page 1073, which we've cited, says to be plain, a remedy must be certain. An opposed motion to intervene in a hypothetical litigation brought by a third party over whom the United States has no control is clearly not a certain path for the United States to vindicate its interests. Finally, we haven't talked about the equities on this preliminary injunction, but as again, Little Man in the Boat said, the RHA limits the conduct of non-federal entities for the benefit of the public at large. We ask that you reverse. Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel for your helpful arguments. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court.